This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we get a little of this.
So this is what we're living with in South Carolina and Georgia. And we're spending $500 million a year. All the plutonium is coming back to Savannah River site on the Savannah River. And we have no customers for this boondoggle.
To avoid a big dose of this.
I was in Tokyo in February. I was on the book tour. And I brought plastic bags with me. And every day I would walk outside and grab some dirt from where I was. And all five bags would qualify as radioactive waste here in the country. And this was on the streets of Tokyo. So, you know, what we would have to ship to Texas and store by our standards in Tokyo was ubiquitous.
But I'll take you on a tour of good news as well as we join your environmental road trip in America.
Strider.
Oh, I'm a Strider rider.
We're thinking about instituting push your vehicle to work day.
Push your vehicle to work day.
Yeah, I like it.
That might be a tough sell.
I wouldn't even make it, especially if you got to go uphill.
Well, that's why I would make sure that I have a job that's downhill from my house. And I'm not sure how I would get back from work, but at least getting to work, I wouldn't get fired.
That one time.
That's for sure.
What do you think about riding in a vehicle that weighs 20 times as much as we do?
I think it's pretty wasteful.
People would think twice about hauling that much weight around.
You think the people will throw their backs out trying to push their vehicle to work?
Well, you know what? For the good of the environment, you got to suffer sometimes.
I'm Alex Smith. Welcome back from the holidays. And what a strange time it was for all the species in the Northern Hemisphere. Let's take a quick look at Christmas Day 2012, for example. In southern France, people were sunbathing and swimming in the Bay of Biscay. It was 24 degrees centigrade or a balmy 75 degrees Fahrenheit, 12 degrees above normal. On the very same day, about 83 people were found dead of extreme cold in the Ukraine. A huge cold snap descended on Moscow, where the temperature dipped to minus 25 degrees Celsius, 13 below Fahrenheit. Russians expect that maybe later in the winter, but not in December. At least 125 people died in the extreme cold in Russia and dozens more in Poland, which suffered unusual cold. The continent-sized cold wave extended all the way to China. Beijing temperatures dropped to about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 15 degrees Celsius, the lowest temperature for the area since 1985. But not in the UK. Britain suffered yet another deluge in what has turned out to be the wettest year in the history of that famously wet island. 2012 was the year the rain hardly ever stopped. In the southern U.S., rare Christmas tornadoes ripped in. Snow fell in Dallas, just the start of a 1-2 snowstorm that traveled up the Midwest to New England and eastern Canada. At the end of December, Montreal, Canada, a city fairly well known for heavy snow dumps, experienced the heaviest snowfall in 24 hours ever. Not just for that day in history, I mean the most snow to fall in 24 hours in their records. At least 45 centimeters fell on Thursday, topping the previous high of 41 centimeters in March 1971. That's 18 inches. And over 2 feet fell in other parts of the province. That is an extreme precipitation event. Now remember, it was like spring in eastern Canada and most of the United States in early December, just 2 weeks previous. A huge change. Here is how ABC News described the warm weather on December 5th, 2012.
And at this point, 2012 is on track to be the warmest on record in the lower 48.
It's bizarre. It's really bizarre, and it makes me so incredibly happy.
Linda's not alone. In Chicago, warm winter coats and hats were replaced by T-shirts and shorts this week. The Windy City soared almost 30 degrees above average Monday to 70.
It puts me in a great mood, but it doesn't feel like Christmas.
The far-from-holiday heat marched east, where joggers in Central Park enjoyed a balmy 62-degree day, 15 degrees above the average temperature. Across the country, there have been 400 record high temps this December alone. The reason? A strong ridge of high pressure, a kink in the jet stream, allowing spring-like temperatures to sneak up where they don't usually hang out.
That was one of the few instances in major American media where the cause of unstable weather was revealed. It is a wildly fluctuating jet stream, just as I've been documenting on Radio EcoShock for some time. Looking at these weather swings in the Northern Hemisphere, I was haunted by this description by EcoShock guest Paul Beckwith in our December 19th show.
Radio EcoShock.
The pattern is not regular like it used to be. There used to be a strong polar vortex that sort of confined it, mostly west to east winds. But the winds are very wavy. The Rossby waves are, you know, extremely wavy, and they rotate around and they slice through. And when the trough slices through where you're living, like in Ottawa, for example, I mean, it's like minus 10 degrees now. When the ridge was slicing through Ottawa last week, it reached about 18 degrees Celsius in Ottawa just last week. I wore shorts last week, you know, and I, you know, as I look on the pattern changing, I mean, this is going to be what's happening. You know, you get the ridge and you get the trough and you get really warm, really cold. Like, normally we expect that as you go north, it gets colder. As you go south, it gets warmer. But what's happening is, you know, if you're under the jet stream, it's warmer. You're getting air from south. If you're above it, it's colder. You're getting air from the north. And because these things are so wavy and the amplitude of the waves is can cross almost the whole continent, like, you know, 1,500 kilometers or more, you get these bizarre changes. And they can be very rapid because as the wave moves past you, you could have it great one day and super, like, warm one day, super cold the next day. So it's really bizarre, and I'm convinced that it's tied to sea ice.
Isn't that exactly what is happening? The European media is generally more up on their science and less dependent on climate denial. When the BBC looks into Britain's never-ending rain, they find the scientists who explain the big waves of the jet stream that stick and stall in certain weather patterns. Tim Palmer, professor of climate physics at the University of Oxford, explains, when the jet stream moves up to the north and then travels back down to the UK, it brings with it cold air, blizzards, very severe and unpleasant weather from that perspective. On the other hand, when the jet stream moves south, then we get those periods of intense flooding which we have seen through the second part of this year. But Professor Palmer says that with climate change, the jet stream could become more variable. He says, the question of how it will change is still a very active research problem, and we don't have clear-cut answers yet. But I think there is quite a big possibility that what we will see is the jet stream undergoing quite dramatic and erratic excursions, and the UK's geographical position under the jet stream means we would see the worst of this. Professor Palmer explains, I think it is a bit unwise and possibly even a bit dangerous to think that the climate of the UK will gradually warm and will transition to a more balmy southern European climate. End quote of Professor Palmer from that story in the BBC. And you'll recall that 2011 was just the opposite in Great Britain. They suffered a major drought that hurt agriculture. Wild, wild swings in extreme weather. What could possibly cause that? Who could have foreseen it? You know, scientists have predicted exactly that scenario for more than a decade. Even the staid Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change felt driven to release a special report on extreme weather events in a warming world. Most of those scientists thought, and even I thought, that we'd see a really big disruption coming much later, perhaps by 2030 or 2040. But just like the record meltback of the Arctic sea ice this year, and the quickening pace of glacier melt, severe climate change is coming much faster than we thought. As Professor Palmer says, it's a mistake to picture a gradual warming that will make cool places more pleasant and winters a happy season. Instead, we're going to get buffeted by big temperature swings and extreme precipitation events, whether in rain or snow. Welcome to the new normal, when nothing is normal. All that is going to hurt the plant and animal world, which means unpredictable food prices as well. Who can predict when the flooded fields will allow planting in Britain this year, or when the U.S. West and Midwest will get enough water to feed cattle and corn? These conditions also cost governments more and more. As of this broadcast, the paralyzed and nearly bankrupt American government still had not passed the $60 billion aid package for Hurricane Sandy victims. That's not to speak of the multi-billions we now know are needed for storm surge protection for major American cities like New York, Washington, and many more. The British government has also broken slashing budgets, including the very flood defense money they need right now. As John Vidal reports in the Guardian newspaper December 28th, the UK government is cutting flood protection money. They cut 95 million pounds a year until the embarrassing floods in Wales this past October. Now there are bigger promises to spend more over many years, but it's still less than previous governments allotted to flood protection. My point is simple. Due to a combination of economic fraud at the highest levels of banking, wild government misallocation of funds, continued militarism, and the consumer dream of infinite growth, we are socially fragile just at the very time climate damage is beginning. And these are the very early days of climate disruption, and we're handling it badly, if at all. Our best hope may be the continued cost of punishing climate change might divert military spending into climate resilience, concurrent with the demand for a rapid shift away from fossil fuels. I know many of you have given up on big national governments. Me too. Some of us dream of smaller bioregional governments or even extreme localization. One problem with all that is we face a global problem in climate change and the closely related energy picture. We may need at least part of those big governments after all, and even the highly feared, hyped global bodies needed to regulate a nature-safe economy for human beings and all species. Otherwise, will we survive? You can comment in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info or write me with your tips and ideas. My address is radio@ecoshock.org. Meanwhile, watch out for those big waves in the jet stream and hope you are on the right side of the bend. It will help if you can use what you learn on Radio EcoShock to educate your friends, family, and neighbors to the real causes of the so-called weird weather. My friends, there is a huge pile of stinking badness coming from the nuclear mafia in the United States. It just keeps going on and on. Two states are begging for tons of the worst radiation on Earth, deadly plutonium. And a small village in Alaska is the testing ground, the guinea pigs, for a new push of mini-reactors. Those are the ones the big corporations want you to swallow, now that their so-called renaissance of giant reactors has failed. Imagine you know and love your state or your province and region deeply. You adventure through the highlands, gaze over the rivers that seem almost sacred in their beauty. You imagine that timeless gift passing down through the generations. So how do you feel when you know your government teams up with some mega corporation to experiment with radioactive materials, the ones that remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, when they truck bomb-grade plutonium along your freeways and neighborhoods? On December 1, 2012, the Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, held their Mountain of Waste 70 Years High conference in Chicago, USA. You can watch the YouTube videos from the conference at their website at neis.org, or find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I got this audio courtesy of Dale Lehman at WZRD Chicago, the free-form radio station operating from Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. Even these first-rate panelists were no match for the residents and activists that are hopping mad about horrible machinations to irradiate and endanger their home grounds from South Carolina through the Southwest all the way to Alaska. I'm going straight to the question and answer period to give you a taste of what's going on out there. Just listen to the pain and betrayal in South Carolina.
It's the MOX program. I believe some of the Rocky Flats plutonium ended up in my state of South Carolina at the under-construction MOX facility, which is another, I think, crossing gray area between commercial and weapons, because they're trying to build this plant to burn this MOX fuel to go where we don't know. And I'm just curious if y'all have any comments about that. And the other thing that I haven't seen on the agenda here is this idea of bringing all the spent fuel to a DOE site, which my state is in the crosshairs of dumping this 70,000 tons plus whatever else is being created at a central location, which when I saw the graph with the Savannah River site and all the radiation, I'm like, well, that just puts it over the top there, doesn't it? So I wondered if they would speak about either one of those or both.
Yeah, thanks. Bob, do you want to talk about MOX?
Well, yeah, sure. The mixed oxide program is essentially a program to try to mix plutonium from nuclear weapons with uranium to fuel commercial nuclear power plants. It's estimated to cost, at least in terms of construction, about $5 billion. And if you look at the MNO management operating costs or life cycle costs, it's probably going to be 4 to 5 times more than that. The timing of this facility is such as by the time that any large quantity of MOX material be available for nuclear power plants, assuming they can overcome certain safety problems, which are not minor. A lot of these power plants will be closed. The thing about MOX is that it makes the spent fuel much, much more radioactive, and you can't recycle this stuff despite what the French say. They only do it once through. Once you start to use large amounts of plutonium or any significant amount of plutonium in a commercial reactor, you're not burning up that much. You're burning up about 20% of it, and the rest of it remains. But what happens is that it renders the spent fuel fantastically more radioactive and gives off a greater amount of what they call decay heat. And the decay heat is so great that in some instances, this stuff will have to cool off for 150 years before you can even think about putting it into a geologic repository.
Thanks. Did you want to talk about DOE repository sites?
Well, there's only one. It's the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, right. And that this is currently receiving and disposing of transuranic wastes, although I think it's going to be a candidate for disposal of military high-level radioactive waste in the future.
Good, thanks. I am, in the interest of time, going to ask the man in the blue shirt be the last person to ask questions, so no more new people in the line. And I thought the gentleman in the yellow
shirt. Well, my friends let me up.
Okay.
My friends let me up.
All right.
Because I'm on the same vein as Susan, and we need to finish this. So, Bob, I should have said hello this morning. I'm sure you would have covered MOX more thoroughly instead of glossing over it. So this is what we're living with in South Carolina and Georgia. And we're spending $500 million a year. All the plutonium is coming back to Savannah River site on the Savannah River. And we have no customers for this boondoggle. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to be opposed to this MOX plutonium fuel, but we have no customers. TVA is a quasi-federal agency, and they got forced into the tritium program, and I think that's DOE's plan now, is to force them to take MOX. But even if that happened, they're facing 10 years of licensing and testing, and they've got like a 40-year-old Fukushima-style reactor and nearly that old ice condenser dismal reactor. So I just want everybody to know this, and that there's a really campaign that's growing legs with the budget. People are figuring out this is the factory to nowhere.
Thanks.
So you may want to comment on that, yeah. But my other little piece is to add on to what Susan said. She did not mention that the state of South Carolina has asked for all the spent fuel to come. I mean, this is a work in progress. At Savannah River site in South Carolina is saying, yucca failed, bring it here. So y'all, South Carolina is poised to be the new yucca, and we desperately hope and believe that the same national energy will prevent that from happening. And what Bob pointed out is coming down the pike. We got
thank
to redo
you.
Our
thank
nuclear
you.
Program.
Thank you very much. We're really pleased to hear about that, and thank you for sharing all the details.
So the state of South Carolina is begging for the whole country's nuclear waste to come there now that Yucca Mountain has failed? That is such treason for Carolinians. We have to ask ourselves, why are governments so suicidal, even terroristic, to their own people? Only big lobby money and the hope of endless government subsidies could explain it. The same dangerous plutonium game is going on in New Mexico. Listen to this.
Actually, my name is Robert Chavez, a member of Think Outside the Bomb and Honor Our Public Existence. I actually don't have a question as much as I do have a comment. One of the comments I wanted to make was on the MOX fuel. It involves my community, Los Alamos. They want to do is they want to bring 13 metric tons of the plutonium, and they want to convert it into this MOX fuel via the Aries process. So they want to take a plutonium pit and basically chop it in half, and through the Aries project, turn it into plutonium oxide and mix it with uranium oxide to create these eraser-sized pellets of fuel. And, you know, I really don't want that to happen. And the second point I wanted to make was on the waste isolation plant. It's the only geological repository in the Department of Energy. And by law, it's limited to 175,000 cubic feet of transuranic waste. And the waste that you're talking about, the energy waste, is only 2 metric tons of activated metals. And that is 160 million curies of radiation. The 175,000 pounds limited by law is only 3 million curies of radiation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to get an idea of the problem that we're facing.
What about nukes on the Great Lakes?
Barbara Wimsatt, one question I have is about the Great Lakes, which is 20% of the world's fresh water, and it's
ringed by nuclear power plants. I think that's a disturbing situation, and I'm also wondering what effect it's having on the water.
I think it's important to understand, first of all, that given that nuclear power is a lot like cutting butter with a chainsaw, that is that you've got only 33% of the energy generated in the fission process actually going to turbines. The rest of, you know, the principal is waste heat. And so every nuclear power plant requires tremendous amounts of water. The Oyster Creek nuclear power plant in on Barnegat Bay in New Jersey takes in on the order of 1.5 billion gallons of water a day. It basically recycles Barnegat Bay through its cooling system, thousands of times every year. And with those tremendous intake, that tremendous discharge of thermal pollution, there is always the fact that the piping systems in these nuclear power plants are deteriorating. With that deterioration, we see accelerated leakage. And then there's also the deliberate venting. So you have this, basically sieves that are being created for all the isotopes that are generated and leaking out of the fuel and eventually getting into the water. There is, the only way to address that is to shut these things down. That is the principal and quick route to go.
And don't forget, we learned at this conference that these dirty projects, and especially the waste reprocessing and all that junk, the dirty reactors, it goes to those areas where people are the poorest, often in the South, and often people of color.
And with that, I also want to say that, you know, it's not just young people that are missing in this room, but one of the things I was going to talk about, I kind of ran out of time, is the fact that primarily where these new reactors are being sited, and I actually went through the U.S. Census demographics for each of these communities and took a look at who's in those communities. And it's primarily communities of color with excessively high poverty rates where we've chosen to site these. Places where we already have reactors, yes, but specifically sited in poor communities of color. That's a big issue. And when I look around that room, I don't see those faces here. And so that's another outreach issue where we need to be building meaningful relationships and framing our issues in a way not only that communicates to, say, younger people, but actually building partnerships with impacted reactor communities that aren't represented in this movement yet.
We might as well poison the whole Yukon River basin with nuclear waste, too. Why leave the Arctic without a whack of radioactivity? Thank you, Toshiba Corporation.
Make it very short. My name's Nikos Pastos. I'm from Alaska. I'm an American Indian. We're here with an all-volunteer group. We're a coalition from Alaska Intertribal Council, Alaska's Big Village Network. I work with Center for Water Advocacy. We're collaborating with Haifa Films. They're based here in Chicago. We're making a documentary. If anybody'd like to meet with us today at the reception and put some kind of testimony on film. I work on the front end and the very back end of the nuclear fuel cycle, and we work on the human right to water and water quantity issues. So we, in our legal work, in our advocacy work, we try to curtail governments from permitting the unjust use of water. My questions are, and these are questions and comments at the same time, does anybody here, are you aware that Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska is one of the main sources of funding for the nuclear power plants? We have a small population in Alaska, okay, but we have no funding to work. Many people, actually communities are concerned, but there's no organization watchdogging, where a lot of the impetus for funding or externalizing all of this unjust waste. Okay, but Alaska is important for many, many reasons. We work with over 230 tribal communities throughout Alaska. It's significant to the food security of the world as well as our national security. And I think the security of human beings, the dignity of human beings. Right now, the Norwegians are pushing a large liquefied natural gas container. They're made in Korea. They're using nuclear icebreakers from Russian nuclear icebreakers. The other thing is we're looking at vessel traffic coming from the tar sands, which there's been many nuclear disasters in the Arctic, which you may or may not know about. Also, we have a lot of uranium, rare earth elements, other energy minerals in Alaska. But if we have one of those containers spill, or we have one nuclear icebreaking accident in the Arctic, we're going to lose a lot of the world's protein source. And so I'm suggesting and asking the panel, I was very happy that, Kendra, you brought up environmental justice. Tribal communities, federally recognized tribes within the United States framework, have special, there's special duties that the federal agencies have to give, government-to-government consultation, yeah, accountability. Okay, has anybody considered working with frontline communities and governments, polities that we have existing, traditional structures that we've had for thousands of years? We need national and international organizing. We don't have any money for this. But a lot of the problems and a lot of the dangers are being borne by frontline communities in Alaska. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'll address the specifically the Alaska water issue. I think that it's important for us all to know that right now, you know, the large reactor renaissance, as it's called, or the relapse, as it really is, it's failed. But the move is afoot now for what they call small modular reactors, so that they're going to look to revive their future in new reactors by building these little ones. And the fight against those little ones really begins in Alaska, interestingly enough, where there's a town there called Galena. Galena's 800 people. And Toshiba is very interested and in, has been in talks with the mayor of Galena to build a what they call the 4S Toshiba, but it's a liquid sodium reactor that they propose to bury under the permafrost, 100 feet under the permafrost on the Yukon River floodplain. So the last of the pristine rivers in the world, there have been negotiations and machinations to put a liquid sodium reactor under the permafrost on the floodplain there in the middle of Alaska. And the entire Yukon River Intertribal Council has mobilized. This is their livelihood. This is their salmon fishing. This is their water source. And that has been a battle that is being won right now. And it is the principal first battle in this emerging battle against small modular reactors. So our hats are off. We've worked with the Yukon River Intertribal Council, and their work is exemplary for the small modular reactor fight that's coming in many places.
We've been looking at nuclear hotspots all around America. That's partly to honor the world's leading anti-nuclear activist, Dr. Helen Caldicott. After 197 shows, Caldicott is ending her radio program called If You Love This Planet. She wants to concentrate on organizing conferences and books, starting with the symposium on the medical and ecological impacts of the Fukushima nuclear accident, to be held at the New York Academy of Medicine in March 2013. Get the details at helencaldicott.com. When we come back, you'll hear from another nuclear critic, former industry VP Arnie Gunderson, now with the consulting firm Fairwinds.com. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock for the reason why we need nuke shut down now.
Like it or not, gotta work for Earth for what it's worth, 'cause it's the only